Ekatra Podcast Conversations, for the curious essential knowledge, simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Ekatra AI. Welcome to the deep dive. Today, we are immersing ourselves in a book that really didn't just shake up economics departments. It sort of reset the whole global conversation about wealth.
Yeah, we're diving into Thomas Piketty's huge 2013 work, Capital in the 21st Century.
A monster of a book, but incredibly important.
Absolutely. And our mission today is, well, it's pretty ambitious. We want to unpack Piketty's core idea, you know, the mechanism he identifies for why wealth inequality seems to be accelerating.
Right. And tackle that big question. Does free market capitalism, just left on its own, naturally steer us back towards a world kind of dominated by inherited fortunes, like Downton Abbey, but with smartphones?
Sort of, yeah. Is that the default setting?
Piketty's real strength, I think, is taking just mountains of historical data, centuries of it, and boiling the problem of inequality down to this this almost deceptively simple relationship.
Mm.
It's a powerful statement about how capital works, and it's really forced everyone, policymakers, investors, just anyone curious, to grapple with the fact that, yes, the rich are getting richer, and maybe the system itself kind of favors the old money over new effort.
It's a huge claim, but what makes it so compelling is the person behind it and the data. Before we get into the nuts and bolts of RGRA, maybe let's talk a bit about Thomas Piketty himself.
Good idea. So Piketty, he's a French economist, born in 71, got his PhD super young, like 22.
Wow.
Yeah. And he co-directs the World Inequality Lab now. But what really makes him stand out isn't just, you know, the academic credentials.
No, what's really fascinating is that he's not primarily a theorist sitting around making abstract models.
Mm-hmm.
Piketty realized that to understand inequality over the long haul, you needed long-term data, serious data.
Right.
So he dedicated his career basically to this incredibly painstaking work, digging up historical records, tax archives, estate records, income data.
Across centuries.
Across centuries, yeah. And across multiple countries, France, the UK, the US, others too. It was a massive undertaking.
That's proper economic history, not just theory. While, you know, earlier thinkers like Marx had big ideas about capital, they didn't really have this kind of empirical grounding for the very long term.
Exactly. Piketty grounds the whole debate in actual historical facts. It moves the conversation away from like short-term stock market blips and towards these deep underlying patterns.
And that historical perspective is key, isn't it? It lets him see beyond the day-to-day noise and identify these sort of tectonic shifts in wealth distribution over generations.
Yeah, and he blends the economics with history, sociology, even literature sometimes. It makes his conclusions much harder to just wave away.
Okay, so let's get to it. The thesis that launched a thousand think pieces. It all comes down to three letters and a symbol.
What IOD dollars?
This is the absolute core. $2 stands for the rate of return on capital.
Okay, so what's capital? Stocks, bonds, real estate? Exactly. It's the income you get passively from assets you already own. Dividends, interest, rent, capital gains, that kind of thing.
Yeah, and dollar.
Dollars is the rate of economic growth. So the growth of the entire economy's output, which, you know, generally translates into how fast wages and overall labor income are growing.
Okay, so if dollars, the return on existing wealth, is consistently higher than dollar,
yeah,
the growth of new income, what happens?
Well, the consequence is pretty straightforward and relentless. Wealth that was accumulated in the past capital, it just grows faster than income earned today from working.
Yeah.
So if the returns on your investments consistently outpace the average person's wage growth, the people who own capital inevitably pull further and further ahead. Their wealth concentrates at the top. It's compound interest working on large fortunes.
And this really cuts against what a lot of 20th century economics suggested, right? Yeah. The idea that capitalism sort of naturally leads to less inequality over time.
Precisely. Piketty argues the opposite. That relatively equal period in the mid-20th century, say, the 1930s to the 1970s, that wasn't capitalism's natural tendency kicking in.
It wasn't the norm.
He argues it was an anomaly, a historical exception. That period where inequality actually fell was caused by massive violent shocks.
Right.
Two world wars physically destroying vast amounts of capital, the Great Depression wiping out asset values, and then governments stepping in with really aggressive policies, very high top income tax rates, strong regulations.
So the stark warning is, mm-hmm, without those kinds of shocks or deliberate policy interventions, the underlying physics of the system, the drawdown G dynamic, just pulls us back. Back towards what he calls a patrimonial capitalism.
Exactly. Back towards something like the 19th century Gilded Age, where inherited wealth, not necessarily current effort or talent, becomes the main determinant of economic power.
Wow. Okay, that's the big picture. Let's dig into the mechanics a bit more. How does he build this argument with the data?
Okay, so first, he makes a clear distinction. You've got income, which is a flow like your paycheck each month.
Right.
And then you have capital, or wealth, which is a stock, the total value of everything you own at a point in time. Assets minus debts. He notes that in developed countries, the income generated by that capital stock typically makes up about, say, 25-30% of the total national income.
Okay.
Then he introduces a key ratio, the capital to income ratio. He calls it beta.
Beta, yeah. So that's how much wealth a country has compared to its annual income.
Exactly. Think of it like this. If a country's total private wealth adds up to 6 times its annual national income, then beta is 600%.
Gotcha. And what does the history of beta show?
It shows this really striking U-shaped curve over the last couple of centuries.
It's true.
Yeah. Beta was very high back in the 19th century, maybe 600, 700% in places like France and Britain. Huge amounts of accumulated wealth relative to income.
Okay.
Then between roughly 1914 and 1950, it plummeted. Wars destroyed capital, inflation eroded its value, governments taxed it or nationalized assets.
The bottom of the U.
Right. But then, starting around the 1970s, that ratio started climbing again, steadily. And now, in the 21st century, it's approaching those 19th century levels again in many countries.
So the sheer amount of private wealth relative to the economy's annual output is getting massive again.
Correct. And to make this feel real, not just abstract numbers, Tickety does something quite cool. He uses 19th century literature, Jane Austen, Balzac.
Wait, Jane Austen? How does Pride and Prejudice fit in?
Well, think about it. He argues those novelists were actually sharp economic observers. In Balzac's novels, for instance, the most rational path for an ambitious young man wasn't necessarily to study law or medicine.
It was.
It was to marry into wealth, to find an heiress. Because the return you could expect from inheriting or marrying capital was often much larger and more secure than what you could hope to earn through a lifetime of work.
So marrying Mr. Darcy wasn't just romantic, it was the 19th century equivalent of a winning lottery ticket.
Pretty much. It shows how that high capital income ratio wasn't just a statistic. It shaped social reality, life choices, everything.
Okay, that makes sense. But why does that ratio, beta, tend to get so big when things are stable? This leads to his fundamental laws, right?
Yes. Let's look at the second fundamental law first, because it explains the size of beta. The formula is beta equals S divided by GS is savings rate.
Right, the proportion of national income that's saved each year. And G, as we know, is the economic growth rate.
Okay, so beta equals SG. What's the logic?
It's quite powerful. Think about it. If the savings rate stays reasonably constant, but the growth rate slows down, which tends to happen as economies mature, population growth slows, technological frontiers are reached,
then the denominator, GFD dollars, gets smaller.
Exactly. So even with modest savings, if growth is slow, that saved capital piles up over time. The total stock of wealth becomes enormous relative to the annual flow of income.
Mm.
Slow growth basically makes past accumulation loom larger over the present economy.
Okay, so low growth helps explain why the total pile of wealth gets so big relative to income. Now, how does that big pile translate into greater inequality? That's where the first fundamental law comes in. Alpha equals R times beta.
Alpha equals R times beta. Alpha is?
Alpha is capital's share of national income, the slice of the total economic pie that goes to owners of capital, as opposed to labor.
Got it.
So if the capital stock is very large, because dollars is low, as per the second law, and the rate of return on that capital stays reasonably stable,
then taller times a large beta means alpha gets bigger.
Precisely. The owners of capital automatically capture a larger share of the total national income.
And if capital share goes up, then labor share wages and salaries must, mathematically, go down, or at least stagnate relative to capital income.
That's the mechanism. Slow growth inflates the capital stock, and a large capital stock combined with a positive return increases capital's overall share of income. It structurally tilts the balance away from labor and towards capital.
Okay, now let's connect this to today. We hear a lot about the 1%. Often focusing on CEOs with massive salaries, super managers, as Piketty calls them. Isn't that about high labor income, not capital.
That's a really important point, and Piketty addresses it directly. Yes, especially in the U.S., a significant part of the rise in top incomes over the last few decades has been extremely high compensation for top executives and finance professionals.
So meritocracy in action, some would say, rewarding top talent.
Perhaps. But Piketty argues this might be sort of a transitional phenomenon. These super managers are earning vast sums in labor income now, yes, but what are they doing with it?
Saving and investing it.
Exactly. They are rapidly converting that labor income into huge piles of capital, and because we're likely back in an anarcho world.
That capital will grow faster than the economy.
And it will likely be passed down to the next generation, creating new dynasties of inherited wealth. So the high labor income inequality of today could be seeding the return of patrimonial capitalism tomorrow.
Patrimonial capitalism. That phrase really sticks. It suggests a shift from a society potentially driven by talent and effort, even if unequal, to one dominated by inheritance.
That's the concern, that we're moving towards a future where your economic destiny is determined less by what you do and more by what you inherit. The entrepreneurs or supermanagers of one generation potentially become the rentier class of the next.
Okay, let's pull back a bit and maybe summarize some of the really key themes or messages that run through this massive work. What stands out?
I think the first and maybe most jarring is that historical exceptionalism of the mid-20th century.
Yeah, the idea that the period many of us think of as normal, you know, relatively high growth, falling inequality, strong middle class was actually the weird bit.
Exactly. It forces you to question this default assumption that capitalism just naturally becomes more equal over time. Piketty says, no, that period was the result of catastrophic shocks and deliberate, strong government intervention. It really reframes how you see history.
Which leads kind of naturally to the second theme, the limits of meritocracy.
Mm-hmm. We all value education, hard work, skills, human capital. And they do matter for your labor income. But Piketty's point is that when $ is significantly greater than D-dollars, the returns flowing to financial capital eventually become so powerful, especially at the very top, that they swamp the returns you can get from just working, no matter how skilled you are.
So meritocracy might help you climb the ladder, but it doesn't really address the concentration of wealth happening at the very, very top, driven by assets.
That seems to be the argument. It can't, on its own, counteract the R.G. Dottle dynamic for the truly massive fortune.
Okay. Third theme.
That history and politics shape economics. This is crucial. Economic outcomes aren't just the result of some abstract natural market forces.
They're choices.
They're the result of political battles, institutional designs, policy choices, tax laws, inheritance rules, regulations, deregulation. So rising inequality isn't like bad weather. It's more like a political decision reflected in policy over decades.
Right. And the final theme touches on something very relevant today, global capital mobility.
Yeah. The issue now is that capital, especially financial capital, is incredibly mobile. It flows across borders easily.
Which makes it hard for any single country to tax it effectively.
Yeah, exactly. If one country raises taxes on capital significantly, the capital might just move elsewhere to a place with lower taxes. This makes tackling wealth concentration a fundamentally international problem.
Which is why he ends up proposing solutions that require global coordination, right?
Yes, like his controversial idea of a global tax on capital. We can get into that maybe, but the point is the problem itself has gone global.
Okay. Piketty's writing is dense with data, but he also has these really memorable lines that capture his core ideas. Maybe we can share a few.
Definitely. I think this one sums up the main thesis perfectly. When the rate of return on capital exceeds the rate of growth of output and income, capitalism automatically generates arbitrary and unsustainable inequalities that radically undermine the meritocratic values on which democratic societies are based.
Wow. That connects the math, 280s owls, directly to a threat against democracy and the idea of a fair society. It's not just numbers.
Not at all. And then there's this incredibly concise, almost poetic phrase, the past devours the future.
The past devours the future. What's that getting at?
It's about the power of inherited wealth, how wealth accumulated generations ago can grow faster than the wealth being created today through work, meaning the past literally shapes and constrains the opportunities of the present and future. Old money overshadows new effort.
That's powerful. And one more.
How about this one, challenging the idea of self-correcting markets? There is no natural, spontaneous process to prevent destabilizing inegalitarian forces from prevailing permanently.
So the market won't just fix this on its own.
That's his argument. If you want less inequality, less instability from that concentration, you have to actively choose policies to make it happen. It requires conscious, democratic intervention.
Okay, so this is fascinating, maybe a bit daunting.
Mm-hmm.
What are the practical takeaways? How can understanding Ordi Dollar apply to our lives,
right,
you know, as listeners?
Well, on a personal finance level, it does kind of reinforce the idea that relying solely on your salary, on your labor income, might be tough for building long-term wealth.
Because Ordi Dollar is likely to grow faster.
Over the long run, historically, yes. So it underlines the importance of trying to build some capital assets yourself, even small amounts, and diversifying them, things like stocks, maybe real estate if possible, participating in the TOR side of the equation, not just the TORUS side.
Makes sense. And what about thinking about society, politics?
It gives you a much clearer framework for evaluating policy debates. When you hear discussions about progressive income taxes or inheritance taxes, or especially the idea of a wealth tax,
which Piketty advocates for.
Yes, his main policy proposal is a progressive global tax on capital. But understanding the Dora logic helps you see why these proposals exist. They aren't just about raising money. They're attempts to directly counteract that fundamental tendency for wealth to concentrate when Dora outpaces dollars. It makes the debates less abstract.
But critics often say that key policy idea, the global wealth tax, is just, well, impossible, politically unworkable. Does he address that?
Oh, absolutely. He's not naive about the political hurdles. He acknowledges it's incredibly difficult to get global agreement on something like that. Tax havens, national sovereignty issues.
So how does he justify it?
He frames it more as a necessary democratic ideal to strive for. Given that capital is global, he argues any effective response must also be coordinated globally to prevent capital flight. He compares it to other global challenges like climate change, where international cooperation is essential, even if incredibly hard to achieve. It's presented as a political challenge to overcome, not just a technical impossibility.
Got it. And maybe just understanding this helps explain that feeling many people have, that feeling of running hard but not getting ahead.
I think so. That sense that wages just aren't keeping pace with the soaring cost of assets like housing or the stock market. Piketty provides a structural explanation for why that feeling might be grounded in reality.
Okay, let's wrap up. As we reflect on this deep dive, what's the one thing that really surprised you or stuck with you the most?
For me, honestly, it was that reframing of the 20th century. Realizing that the great compression of inequality wasn't the natural path of progress, but this anomaly driven by war, depression, and high taxes. It really shifts your baseline expectation for what normal capitalism looks like if left unchecked.
Yeah, that really landed with me too. It means we can't just assume things will naturally get more equal. My big takeaway is probably how fundamentally political Piketty argues these economic outcomes are. It's not destiny. It's choices about taxes, regulation, institutions.
Right. He really makes the case that you can't divorce economics from justice and politics. His work is almost a call to democratic debate, saying we need to decide what kind of society we want and then design the economic rules to achieve it to make sure wealth serves democracy, not the other way around.
Which leaves us with a pretty big question for you, the listener, to think about. If inequality is, as Piketty argues, fundamentally a political choice, what specific rules or institutions should our society choose today to ensure wealth creation supports democratic values rather than potentially undermining them?
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.